A major practice that characterized the counterculture movement was to turn on, tune in, and drop out. This was according to an apothem coined by Timothy Leary after he and Richard Alpert were fired from Harvard University for turning some of their students on to psychedelics. Indeed, the use of mind-altering substances has been part of virtually every human culture since time out of mind. They have been the subject of legislation in the United States since the mid-19th century. Pot, or marijuana, is now widely recognized for its medicinal properties and is verging into legality once again. But smoking pot, long associated with jazz musicians, beatniks, hippies, rock musicians, and other marginaux, has long since evolved an outlaw culture that takes great umbrage at legislators who construct laws addressing what we may or may not do with our personal consciousness. For Voices of Counterculture, this is Jack Leffler. Consciousness, elevated by the use of psychedelics, including peyote, LSD, and psilocybin, may expand into ecstatic states, create an alternative mental reality, or possibly turn into a bad trip. Neuroscientists continue to delve between the synapses in search of the miraculous. But for those who ingest psychedelics in quest of spiritual awakening of consciousness, moments of such profound awareness may occur that one's life is thereafter lived in a much more meaningful way. Peter Coyote is a successful actor and author who has greatly influenced the flow of counterculture.
We ate peyote and had about 6 or 7 big, fat, juicy buttons each. Everybody just was transported into another zone. As soon as I went outside, hey, this is really weird, man, but I feel like I'm some kind of little wolf. And I started to pant, and I started to dog trot. And I dog trotted all night long out in the woods in the silvery moonlight and under the starlight and licking the tip of my nose to get sensitive to smells. And at dawn, when I woke up in the morning, the ground was muddied with these little tracks. And I didn't know if I had made those footprints or not. Then I met this guy, Rolling Thunder. He was a Shoshone Paiute guy. He had real power. And one day I told him this story about the peyote trip. He pinned me, man. He looked at me. He said, well, what are you going to do about it? And I said, I don't know. What do you mean? He said, well, the universe offered you a great gift. It opened its mind to you. You can treat it as a hallucination. He said, or you can take it as a great gift and you have to respond to it. I thought about it for about 6 months. I decided what I would do is I would take that name and I would find out what it meant. So Coyote sort of gave me a space to be somebody that Peter Cohan was never going to be able to be. Peter Cohan came with so many expectations and middle-class upbringing, and it was very hard to slip that web of expectations. But somehow, as Peter Coyote, it was like a clean slate.
Yvonne Bond was part of an early coterie of peyoteros in Marin County who started to migrate to New Mexico in 1962. She is an archetypal counterculturalist who has lived her long life according to her own principles. Here, she speaks of her first peyote journey.
Daryl said that you want to stay away from speed. He said it'll destroy the myelin sheaths in your brain, mentally really deranged. So that was really good advice. And he said, stay away from heroin, stay away from barbiturates and things like that. Pot's okay, but let's have the peyote first. So we ate the peyote. He was my guide and my person keeping me safe. We went to Marin County and we went along the coast highway and we stopped. It was really coming on and I had eaten some yogurt and berries. So I traipsed through this wet undergrowth and heaved up my yogurt and berries. And I just had to bow before it because I was looking at God, Holy Spirit, just right there in front of me. And so we went back to the car. We parked along the road so we could look down at the ocean. But I instead turned my back on the ocean and I was looking in wonder at the cars going by. And I said, look at those spaceships floating by. They're just floating on air. I looked at the hillsides and I could see that every plant was a different shade of green. There were 1,000 shades of green, and every plant had its own life, its own color, its own little place in the picture. So that's when I really connected strongly with the spirit of nature and have never left.
Silvio Rodriguez, originally from Taos, is an author and retired professor who began her spiritual quest at an early age.
Peyote. It was a classical mystical experience. I mean, it was profound. And the bottom line was love, transcendent, universal, total. And it really changed me, I think. And I was so young. I mean, that's what it comes down to. I took it in my bedroom, and when I started to throw up, I didn't go to the bathroom. I crawled out of my window and threw up in the garden, and then, you know, whoo! And for a minute there, I panicked. And then it turned, and it just became this ecstatic number of hours. And I think that evening my parents had a little party, and I went to the party, and I thought I was like, you know, fine. But my eyes must have been like pools, you know, but I was in this sort of love state. And, you know, I don't know whether they noticed or who knows how they perceived me, because I was like stone out of my mind or into my mind or whatever, beyond my mind. And it became a turning point for me because, of course, as I say in the essay, I spent quite a number of years trying to recover that state through the use of drugs. You know, I had many different kinds of experiences, but it was a one-time thing. Although I had many extraordinary and, you know, took much more powerful doses later on of LSD and the psychedelics that were easier to ingest, because peyote, as you know, is rough. I knew then that it was a transformative experience, and now, how many years later, I think it was. It was definitely the case. And, you know, I know that a lot of the gurus that people sought out said, you know, those are not real experiences, and you have to stop. And, of course, that's what Barbara and Steve took that path with, starting out with Meher Baba. But it seemed to me like it was the real thing. I mean, that's what William James talks about. And so it launched me on this path that really lasted up until my late 20s.
Another great characteristic of the counterculture, or what Gary Snyder calls the Great Underground, is wanderlust. The lure of the exotic remains palpable. Again, Yvonne Bond.
There's a big Mexico, San Francisco, New Mexico connection. Mexico was our India. And I think that's a good thing to say because so many of the East Coast people went to India. We went to Mexico to find the curanderos, the substances, the experiences, the backcountry people, the campesinos, the real deal.
By recent count, there are 54 distinct languages that are still spoken that are indigenous in Mexico. It is one of the richest of ethnic cultures in the world. The indigenous art forms reflect great imagination. The Huichol Indians of the Sierra Madre Occidental embroider their clothing with peyote visions that reflect their relationship to the natural world. Further south in Oaxaca, the Zapotec and other Indians ingest psilocybin mushrooms in quest of spiritual awakening. Many a hippie pilgrim made the long trek to Huautla in Oaxaca in quest of heightened consciousness. Again, Yvonne Bond.
I went to Mexico and stayed twice for 6 months, with 6 months in between. This was in 1961 and 62. The first time, I stayed a lot in Mexico City. I lived with Daniel Moore, who was a poet, and I had known at UC Berkeley. The second time was really remarkable in that I stayed with Bruce Conner, the artist Bruce Conner, and his wife Jean Sunstedt, who was pregnant at that time with their son Robert. This was an incredible scene. So I'm 22, and I barely knew them. I'd see them at a few parties, right? I was down there in Mexico. I knock on their door in Mexico City and say, "Hi, do you think I could stay here for a while?" And Bruce was a pretty eccentric guy. And Jean was very normal and calm. Bruce was like really hyper and skinny. Without saying a word, he grabs a roll of heavy plastic stuff like you'd put on your windows. He vigorously crunches it all into a big mass, gets a staple gun, and throws this plastic down on the floor and staples it into the wooden floor, right? Throws a blanket on it and puts a pillow on it and said, "There you go." That was the start of my 6 months of staying with Bruce and Jean. We were blessed with a visit from a curandero whose name was Don Isauro, Isauro Nava. How he got our address, I'll never know. It was one of those magical moments. There was a knock on the door. We're on the second or third floor, and there's a very diminutive Mazatec Indian man with a hand-woven bag over his shoulder, campesino clothing, who very softly and humbly says, "I hear there are some people here who would like to have a mushroom ceremony." We said, "Yes." And that was our first mushroom ceremony with Don Isauro Nava. Those present at this ceremony, which lasted all night, were myself, Bruce and Jean, a Mexican middle-class couple whose name I forget, and Timothy Leary. Timothy Leary was also in attendance at this. And Don Isauro Nava's helper, his nephew Bernardo. And the helper would eat half a dose, you know, whereas we all got the complete dose. And he would take care of us. You had to have somebody to take care of you. So all the lights were out and we were doing this. It was notable for both of the Mexican couple, the man and the woman, repeatedly kept trying to jump out of the windows, which were on the second or third floor. And these very diminutive Indian men had to try to physically restrain these much larger people, which took the better part of the night. As a result, we went to Huautla de Jiménez in Oaxaca, which was made famous in some books, I think, by Gordon Wasson about mushrooms and mushroom ceremonies. Because we were invited, Don Isauro Nava invited us there. And it was the kind of place, it's in the Sierra Mazateca, which is quite steep, subtropical, the kind of things where dahlias are growing as a native plant. It's the kind of thing where you take a bigger bus and a smaller bus, and then the rattletrap bus with everyone carrying chickens, and then you get out and walk from there. We got there about dusk. There are people who grow coffee. They were coffee growers. So he had a finca, a little coffee growing outfit, and the women all wore brightly embroidered, really psychedelic, you know, huipiles. These were very nice people, very warm and receiving. They had a little kitchen outdoors. Don Isauro was very political. He had a shortwave radio. There was no electricity there. And he listened to radio stations all around the world. This is a guy that presents himself as a humble and educated person. He wasn't. He was brilliant. He knew what was going on in the world. He impersonated or became several different things in the course of the ceremony, one of which was a Mexican, a mestizo Mexican, singing a typically sad and teary and boozy, sentimental Mexican song, perfectly became that mestizo Indian. And he also said, "Yo soy el águila mexicana." And we're in a little room, and you could hear the wings flapping and feel the breeze. And we just stood there with our heads bowed as he flew around the room. This is where you're melting into everything. It was fresh psilocybe, probably cubensis, that were gathered. We watched them gathering them from some poop in the middle of the road. You know, that's where they grew, you know, animal dung. And he'd look at us and size us up, and he'd put however many mushrooms in the bowl he thought we could handle, which was a bowl full of mushrooms. So what happened with me, and as I've heard about other kinds of ceremonies with mind-altering plants, his aim was to take you as far into the death experience as he could without you actually dying, which I didn't know beforehand. I had to go out and use the bathroom. So Bernardo lifted me up by the arm and took me up outside and made sure I didn't fall down or something. And so I went. And during that time, I mean, it's completely dark. There was no moon. It was like new moon time. I felt that I had died. I was leaving my body. I lifted up out of my body and I said, "Oh, wow, gee, I died so young." that's kind of a shame. And I went higher and higher up in the sky, and I thought, you know, it's not that bad to have died here at this time. This is pretty cool. So I lifted out my arms and flew, and I was out there with the planets and stars and just happily humming along, and I kind of hear this little voice that says, come back, come back. And I go, oh, I guess it's time to come back in my body. So I gradually, you know, drifted down there and settled back into the body. And I guess Bernardo lifted me up off the ground, or it was a 1,000-year journey in 10 minutes or something, you know. And I had the realization of life and death. And that has stayed with me the rest of my life. And when I came back, it was still very dark. And we were getting deeper and deeper into the experience. And not too far before dawn, Don Isauro, he had a simple Mexican candle holder with a little candle in it and a book of matches. He struck a match and lit the candle, and it looked like fireworks going off to us because we had been in the complete dark. And we just instinctively bowed down, and he was bowing and bowing before this flame and said, Es la verdadera luz de Dios. It's truly the light of God.
New Mexico has long been a major nexus for avant-garde bohemians of every ilk. Mabel Dodge Lujan arrived in Taos in 1919 and invited writers, artists, intellectuals, and musicians to spend time at her home, situated near the Taos Inden landscape. She died in 1962, just as the new wave began to trickle into New Mexico. Here, Lisa Law tells of her arrival in New Mexico.
We set up our teepee first at the New Buffalo Commune. We headed straight for New Buffalo because we heard about this commune. And Rick Klein had started it with that $20,000 he had inherited. And he wanted to build a utopia where they were going to all live together, and they were going to raise their food together and raise their babies together, and they were going to live in harmony, and it was going to be beautiful. And Dennis Hopper and Peter Fonda wanted to use their land to shoot the communal scenes for Easy Rider, which Rick wouldn't let him do because he didn't want the publicity. So we helped them make adobe bricks and helped them build their houses and cooked with them. And we stayed there till I got too pregnant, when we decided to move down to Cerro Gordo in Santa Fe. So we all came to Santa Fe, and we ended up setting up our teepee on Cerro Gordo. Eddie Armijo and his brother owned the piece of land on Cerro Gordo that we set up our teepee on. And Steve Samuels and Reno Clean set up their teepee, and Tom and I set up our teepee. And Eddie Escudero and Deputy Sheriff. Eddie Armijo used to ride their horses around our teepee, and we would be inside smoking dope. So I thought that was very funny. And on September 14th, I went into labor with my daughter Pilar and drove down the road to the Catholic Maternity Institute for Natural Childbirth. And the next morning, gave birth to our first daughter, Donna Pilar, which was a beautiful experience. Natural childbirth is and should be practiced every place. It's just a beautiful experience for a woman. We lived on Cerro Gordo for a while, and then we moved to Embudo, and we set up our teepees on Tom Watson's land on the Rio Grande and stayed there until it got too cold. Then we moved to Taos.
Reno Meyerson migrated to New Mexico in the 1960s and recalls how clean the air was from where he lived in Truchas.
Tom Law and his wife Lisa, they had found this property in Truchas. They were growing a family as well. And Tom and I, being business partners and really, really tight friends for a long time, he found a spot up there that he thought I might like. You could see his house from this other place, and it was like, holy moly, it was spectacular. I could see into Colorado, I could see Mount Taylor, I could see beyond Sandia. It was phenomenal viewing post. When the air was there, you could see through all the time in those days. Now, occasionally, you can see it. That's how the planet's changing. We have the cleanest air in the world, they say, but it's not as clean as you can imagine, you folks who might ever listen to this. It used to be pristine. I found this land, I fell in love with it, went through the process and bought it, and lived there for many years before I met my wife and moved out of Santa Fe. So I moved down to Santa Fe.
For many, hitchhiking was the simplest way to get around. I personally first hitchhiked from one end of Route 66 to the other in 1958. Here, Yvonne Bond tells something of her adventures as a hitchhiker.
Linda Ross was a person I spent a lot of time hitchhiking with. We hitchhiked back and forth between Santa Fe and the Bay Area twice with incredible adventures. Linda Ross was a really good blues singer. She was a good 5'8", 5'9", and a good 180, 190 pounds, if not more. And she always dressed in all the clothes she had when we were hitchhiking, which was about three layers of skirts, a whole bunch of jewelry, a pair of sandals, three or four shirts, and we had little old raggedy sleeping bags, army surplus, and we took peanuts and raisins and a canteen of water in our army surplus backpacks, and we wore sandals or moccasins. This was in some of the first days that that was happening. I always wore a Levi jacket and Levi's and a bandana. She'd stick me out with my thumb out and hide, and then she'd jump out. They'd slow down, they'd see me. I was about 20, you know, and then she'd jump out. We'd both get a ride.
Iris Keltz is the author of Scrapbook of a Taos Hippie. She was deeply involved in the Taos communes and was well acquainted with many of the communards.
Well, it used to be that there was an incredible sense of community among the most recent immigrants, let's call us. I don't know how to refer to us, the most recent arrivals in Taos. Of course, there was an incredible overlay of history that took me years to discover. I remember one of my first jobs for actual money in Taos was working at Joe's Restaurant, and all the famous artists would come into the restaurant. And the woman who ran the restaurant, she goes, "Oh, that's so-and-so," and she knew all the famous artists. So they were still alive then. That taught me to have an awareness of that whole level of migration, the artistic part, because I was kind of more focused on the counterculture part. And I definitely like the word counterculture better than hippie. I'm not really fond of the word hippie because counterculture is more specific. It's in response to mainstream culture, whereas hippie, I'm never sure what it means. You know, it seems to mean just flowers and beads and dancing in circles and doing drugs. And the counterculture is much broader based, and I think a much better word to describe the movement.
John Nichols is one of our nation's greatest writers. He moved to northern New Mexico in the late 1960s, lured by the burgeoning Hispano activism that prevailed. His sense of counterculture is far more centered in political activism than in the commune movement. Here, he reveals what happened to him on arriving in Taos.
Reading that newspaper, El Grito del Norte in Española, gave me a lot of information about Reyes Tijerina, the courthouse raid, and Tierra Maria. It was a Pinto newspaper about Chicanos in prison. It was basically a movement newspaper that gradually grew into actually printing articles about Cuba, articles about North Vietnam, you know, that sort of thing. So when I came to New Mexico, I figured, okay, I can't seem to survive in New York City, but I want to go to a place in America where I can still be real active in issues of social justice, environmental justice, whatever. I didn't want to retire to a commune in Vermont. You know, I just thought, oh my God, you know, that is so chicken shit. And I figured in the end that New Mexico was probably the closest I could come to living in the third world while still being in the United States. And so by the time I moved here, I knew a lot of New Mexico politics. I knew that it was probably the poorest or the next to poorest state in the Union. I understood that it, you know, had a very small ruling class that basically controlled most of the economy of the state, etc. And I knew some history of land grants, that kind of thing, and how They'd been stolen in every shape, way, and form by people from the Catron gang, you know, to various organizations in the country. I understood that the Native American population in New Mexico and around the country was at the total bottom of the social and economic heap in our country, right? So I came here believing that I could maintain a lifestyle that was within the movement, that was against the war in Vietnam, and that was involved in issues of equality, social justice, economic injustice, etc., right? And I thought it was real original to move to a place like Taos, New Mexico, right?
Nanao Sakaki was a poet and pilgrim from Japan. He was conceivably the freest person I've ever known. He was content to live in caves or teepees in any weather, absolutely focused on the flow of nature through every habitat that he visited, a man who walked wherever he went, whether in Japan, California, New Mexico, or Tasmania. He was a particularly close friend of John Brandy.
I think it's very fortunate that we had Nanao living on and off in New Mexico for a while. In the literary circles, they finally put him in the cubbyhole as a Japanese beatnik. In New Mexico, younger people thought of him as a guy that just ended up wherever the wind sort of blew him. He was a very, very focused traveler, and he was very intent on reporting the details on every watershed he visited. He could be comparable to the poets Basho and Issa, who got down low and wrote in the vernacular and took to the road as a sort of a disciplined spiritual pilgrimage, but a way of seeing the world through the common folks. He embodied that, but he was more than they were, because he was not only concerned with walking the watersheds, but saving them. And that was what really impressed me about Nanao, is, I mean, learning about him moving on to places like Tasmania, being invited there to speak his poetry and to speak about saving the virgin forests from Japanese pulp industry, or saving Aboriginal lands in Australia from American Japanese corporations, on and on and on. I mean, he was always involved with something very active and meaningful regarding watersheds, not just writing beautiful poems about the details, but that was impressive.
Today, we've heard the voices of Sylvia Rodriguez, Peter Coyote, Yvonne Bond, Lisa Law, Reno Meyerson, John Brandy, Iris Keltz, and John Nichols. Our theme was performed by Carl Bernstein. Voices of Counterculture is funded by grants from the Museum of New Mexico Foundation and the Christensen Fund in San Francisco. Our radio series coincides with Voices of Counterculture in the Southwest, a major exhibition on display at the New Mexico History Museum at the Palace of the Governors in Santa Fe, extending from May 14, 2017 through February 11, 2018. The exhibition is accompanied by a book of the same title, published by the Museum of New Mexico Press. For Voices of Counterculture, this is Jack Leffler. Thank you for listening.